We're delighted to welcome students from West Salem High School. Would they please stand? Thank you for coming today. You may be seated. The students are here with a program titled Court with Class. We invite high school students from around the state to come and hear an oral argument and meet with a justice. The program is sponsored and run by the Supreme Court and by the State Bar of Wisconsin. Students are given material about the case we're about to hear. They may engage in various activities relating to the case. They come, and after this case, they will be joined by other students and will meet with a justice. The discussion will be on the procedures of the court in taking and hearing cases, not on the substantive issues involved in this case. If anyone would like a summary of the case, you'd raise your hand. The marshal will give you a summary. It's easier to listen to oral argument if you understand the facts and the legal issues. Everybody's invited to the discussion after this case. Counsel, too. Let me introduce the court to you all. Justice Michael Gableman is on the far left, and he's the justice with whom you will meet. Seated next to him is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Brooks. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and to her right, Justice David Prosser, and on the far right, Annette Ziegler, Justice Ziegler. I'll now call our second case for this morning, 08AP1303, Roll Transport, Inc. versus Liberty Mutual Insurance Company. And the lineup I have is Attorney King, 25 minutes, representing Roll. Liberty Mutual, represented by Attorney Cat, 25 minutes. Rebuttal by Attorney King, 5 minutes. And then rebuttal by Attorney Cat, limited to the cross appeal. Counsel.
Please the court. Counsel, good morning.
Good morning.
Larry King is my name, and with Matt Biegert, we're representing Rail Transport. After an 8-day jury trial in St. Croix County, that jury returned a verdict of bad faith as to the conduct of Liberty Mutual in the investigation, handling, and defense of a claim that involved our client, Rail Transport. And as a part of that deliberation, returned damages in the favor of Rail in excess of $100,000. Two issues that Rail has raised on appeal relate to attorney's fees, that is, the determination of those attorney's fees, and whether there was a sufficient factual basis, sufficient factual dispute to have submitted the claim of punitive damages that Rail had as to Liberty. Turning members of the court to the attorney's fees claim of Rail. There is not really a dispute on the record before the court as to Rail's right to recover attorney's fees in a bad faith claim in Wisconsin. Rather, the dispute is the mechanism by which those fees are determined. That is, how, when, and who determines the award of attorney's fees in Wisconsin after a bad faith finding.
Counselor, is there any standard for determining the amount of the fees? Do you have to prove they're reasonable, like you sometimes do in a case, or do you simply get actual attorney's fees, or how does that go?
After the court's decision in DeShant, our position is that once the bad faith finding has been determined, as a matter of law, that policyholder is entitled to the actual fees that it incurred in bringing the bad faith case as a matter of law, and that the trial court is in a position to determine the actual fees, and, Your Honor, in our view, to determine the reasonableness of those fees.
Now, actual fees and reasonable fees could be two different things, which is why I asked you the question, because I understood your argument to be you get your actual fees. Well, if you get your actual fees, what fact-finding is the jury going to do? I mean, they are what they are. So I'm interested now if you think that maybe there's a reasonableness test as well.
Well, Your Honor, our view is that the jury never determines the actual attorney's fees incurred in a bad faith case. That as a matter of practicality, a matter of finality, and a matter of focusing upon what the case is about, which is the bad faith conduct of the insurer, to try simultaneously the issue of the attorney's fees is not appropriate. So we believe the post-verdict, as the court did in DeShant, Majorowicz, Danner, the trial court awarded attorney's fees.
Counsel, I can understand how I see these as separate things. And, you know, I put on my trial court judge hat and I think, okay, how are we going to try this case? And when you see a bad faith claim, typically it's somebody who didn't do what they were supposed to do in defending or in proceeding in the underlying cause of action. Somebody had to hire up their own lawyer. They had to go ahead and defend themselves. They had to maybe pay out a claim. You know, and the insurance company should have stepped in and they should have done that, and so it was bad faith, right? So all those things are, I think, compensatory damages for the underlying bad faith and could go before the jury. That makes complete sense to me. Where I have a little disconnect is when you're then proceeding on the bad faith claim to prove that they should have done something differently in the underlying claim, right? How do you prove up the attorney's fees as compensatory damages there? Do you put your own lawyer that's there proceeding on your behalf on the stand and question them as to what the fees are? Do you have the person who paid the bills? You don't even know what your fees are going to be. Do you just do it sort of piecemeal and have the jury guess what they might be at the end? How does that work? Or are you just taking the position when it comes to the prosecution of the bad faith claim, the forwarding of the bad faith claim, trying the bad faith case, that those fees a court should just award, period, and that the analysis doesn't go before the jury? I see those as two separate things. I can see how attorney's fees could be compensatory damages and easily calculated and put before a jury in a subsequent bad faith case. But then when you're actually trying the bad faith case, if you have to put that before the jury, how do you do that without having the lawyer potentially become a witness? That's an issue for me. I'm just trying to figure it out.
Correct. And I assume that that may be one of the reasons why we're before you, so that we can set a policy or discuss with you this morning a policy for the circuit court judges to follow in a bad faith claim where attorney's fees are undoubtedly a part of the claim. Now, Justice Ziegler, trying to respond to your question, which is kind of, as I view it, the practicality of how this case should have gone forward in terms of the fees. First of all, in terms of the bad faith conduct, Liberty was arguing that they could not be held in bad faith unless and until there was an excess verdict greater than $2 million. That's just not the law. The jury was instructed they could find bad faith if Liberty's conduct, as they weighed the evidence, was that Liberty had intentionally or recklessly, actually, disregarded important facts in the case, which the jury then determined. So now we switch hats, and how do we get to an award of attorney's fees, which under DeShant and cases since that, as a matter of law, that policyholder, the insured, Mr. Beeger's client and myself, Rail in this case, are entitled to. Justice Ziegler, you touch on the very practical point that we raise in our briefing. You're not going to have simultaneously with the court and jury looking at bad faith, also looking at attorney's fees, because you're blending two separate things. One, two, you never get to finality with that jury verdict because the fees are going to be post-trial. The fees are right here on appeal. And you're going to have, in that proof phase, while the bad faith conduct's being weighed, the lawyers who are putting on the bad faith case potential witnesses as to the amount of their fees and the reasonableness of their fees simultaneously. It's like a doctor's fees, who is a part of a compensatory damage award, actually doing the surgery in front of the jury and then determining whether that cost was reasonable. That isn't how that works. So what we did in this case, in the pretrial, in the December 07 pretrial before the January actual trial in bad faith, was to take the position with Judge Lindell that post-verdict, pursuant to DeShant, Majorowicz, Danner, that you, Judge Lindell, will determine whether or not we're entitled to attorney's fees, because the factual predicate of whether we're entitled to it hasn't yet been established. That is the finding of bad faith. So going forward, our position is that following DeShant as a matter of law, when the jury finds bad faith, attorney's fees flow from that finding of bad faith, and that the trial judge is in the position to award those fees as damages, because the court has distinguished those types of damages in bad faith cases. The trial court listened to the case, is accustomed to looking at fees, knows the area where the case was tried in Wisconsin, what's practical, what's reasonable, and they're in the best position to award attorney's fees.
Mr. King, didn't you follow a procedure, though, that was different than what was done in DeShant? My understanding is in DeShant, the jury was asked whether or not there was entitlement to attorney's fees, and they answered yes, and they answered in terms of a percentage. You didn't present anything here to the jury in regard to whether or not there was an entitlement to attorney's fees. Isn't that very different than DeShant?
Justice Brooks, let's look at DeShant. Because the reason that the verdict form looks like it looks in DeShant is, of course, fact-specific to DeShant. DeShant was submitted under breach of contract and bad faith. That's the basis why there's that percentage question on that verdict form. Judge Lindell never had that issue. All he had was bad faith. So I'm confident, in my view, that under DeShant at its circuit court level, when it was being tried, the judge realized I may have a post-verdict question about whether a certain percentage of the fees relates to the breach of contract, not recoverable, and a certain percentage relates to the bad faith, which is under Wisconsin law. DeShant, now having been decided by this court, says as a matter of law, attorney's fees flow from the bad faith conduct. And so our view is, and was, before Judge Lindell in December of 07 and when we tried this case, it's not necessary to submit that question to the jury. So DeShant is very helpful because it frames what the law is in Wisconsin once there's a finding of bad faith. But the verdict form of DeShant is unique to the facts of that case. Thinking about the argument that's before you on the bad faith claim, Liberty has a view of the law of Wisconsin that when there's a deductible like this one, which was $500,000, that it has no obligation, no duty to do anything unless and until the verdict comes back in excess of $2 million. That is not consistent with Wisconsin law. Under their theory, Liberty can receive a claim under a policy like Rails, put that claim in the file and do nothing with it, get a complaint and do nothing with that, let it go to default for $490,000, and Rail has no remedy, no right, and under Liberty's view, there was no bad faith. The law of our state is that there is an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing in every insurance contract, big ones, little ones, and everyone in between. And that implied covenant of good faith is imminent in the policy from the outset. And that good faith duty and responsibility rests with the insurer, not on a part-time basis, not when the verdict goes in excess of the cover, but on a full-time basis. And in this case, the jury heard evidence of Liberty's failure to investigate, failure to assign experienced adjusters to adjust the case, conversations with Mr. Groth, who was the underlying claimant in which they wouldn't talk to him about settling his bodily injury claim at an early and critical stage unless and until he got the waiver or the lien cleared off of his vehicle so Liberty could salvage it. So stop and think about that for a moment.
Mr. King, let me interrupt you there again, if I might.
Certainly.
The position taken by Liberty seems to be supported by Hilker, which is a case going back to 1931, seems to be supported by the Krangis decision, seems to be supported by the decision of the Seventh Circuit, which is the Huss case. And all of those cases seem to indicate that there are limited situations where a bad faith claim can be maintained. And it doesn't appear that this kind of situation involving a high deductible amount is one that's covered. Now, I understand your argument is, well, there's this implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Certainly we have other cases that recognize that covenant. But do you think that's enough to overcome the case law as it exists in regard to when a bad faith claim can be maintained in Wisconsin?
Absolutely, Justice Crooks.
Why?
Has the same right. Well, let's start with Hilker, the 1930-31 case. Okay. Could it possibly have been in the contemplation of the court at that time that the evolution of torts in America would get to the point where insurers were out in the marketplace, Wisconsin-based companies running a national trucking company, would enter into a relationship with a national insurer where for both there were economic benefits to have a high deductible? Hilker could not have contemplated that, Justice Crooks. The federal decision that you're referencing, that opinion goes out of its way multiple times to say, in my view, hey, we are basically constrained. We're not here to create, as a Seventh Circuit, new law in Wisconsin.
And, of course, they cannot. They have to accept our substantive law.
They do. So now, Justice Crooks, applying this situation, is it going to be the law of the state that they can waste a deductible by not investigating, by not assigning, by actually telling the claimant, we won't talk to you about the settlement of your bodily injury case until you get the bank to waive the lien, and that will be the policy of this state, that there can't be bad faith in that circumstance? Judge Lindell had no problem with that, saying, no, that fits. You can look at the excess, if you're looking for some excess verdict situation, of our deductible being the excess. They put us in a spot by their conduct, which the judge instructed was reckless if they so found, and they did, of wasting $500,000 of an asset that we had entrusted to them. That implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing can't be limited, can't be as a public policy basis, to just certain types of contracts in certain types of situations. They, under the evidence we presented and the jury determined, wasted $500,000.
As a question of law, though, in all the cases, if I remember them right, that Justice Crooks cited, the issue really was that the damages exceeded policy limits, which made the insured liable, right?
Yes, the cases that reference it.
Right. In this case, the damages are below the policy limits. They're lower than the policy limits. In this case, the insured becomes liable because of the high deductible. So is it your argument that in that sense, this case is like all the others because it is the insured who becomes liable when the duty to defend isn't carefully done? It's just that it's not in excess, it's below the deductible.
Yes, Your Honor, you could look at it in that circumstance because the policyholder is in a position where their asset, in this case the deductible, $500,000, has been wasted as a result of what Judge Lindell instructed the jury, a reckless disregard of facts. So the jury was in a position to listen to and weigh credible evidence from Liberty's own adjusters about whether the matter would have been resolved for less than that deductible. They heard that evidence. They heard the evidence of the lawyer representing Mr. Groth, and of course they heard expert testimony, and were in a position to determine that reckless conduct wasted part of the asset of Rail. And so it is, in that way, analogous to an excess verdict. And I think Judge Lindell didn't have any problem applying existing Wisconsin law on bad faith to a policy that, admittedly, this court has not yet faced, that is a high deductible policy. But the rationale, Chief Justice Abramson, has to be the same. Policyholders in Wisconsin employing Wisconsin folks can't be in a different position simply because they have a higher deductible. Liberty's actually here arguing that my client bargained for the risk. The audacity that my client bargained for the risk and therefore bargained for their bad faith. The jury heard that and really didn't accept it.
Under the contract, the insurance company has the obligation, this is a question, has the obligation to defend from zero up through whatever, up through the $2 million. This was $2 million?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Up through the $2 million?
Yes.
I mean, their duty to defend doesn't start at $501,000.
It does not. They have the duty to defend, the duty to settle, the duty to investigate, which leads back to our discussion on the point we just raised back and forth, of since the duties are not any different under the high deductible policy, then the obligations in terms of bad faith should not be any different. All that there was here were some special handling instructions in terms of communication, but defense counsel was selected by Liberty, defense counsel was reporting to the claims examiners of Liberty, and Liberty was controlling whether they were hiring experts or not.
What did Roll do during that trial or during that time? Did they provide counsel? Did they supervise Liberty Mutual?
Well, as you have in the briefing before you, in 2003, this case went to verdict in June of 2004. In the spring of 2003, as I recall, in terms of responding to your question, what did Rail do? Rail went down to Chicago and wanted to see this claim file in 2003 and was told by the Liberty folks that you won't be permitted to see that claim file. So what did Rail do? Ultimately, following the mediation, or at least, immediately before the mediation or shortly thereafter, Rail insisted that a lawyer that they pick actually try the case. Our point is, by that point in time, the opportunities to settle the case within that deductible had long since passed. Mr. Groth was locked in terms of what he thought the value was, and so was his counsel, Mr. Scow. So this is a situation where the facts may be different, but the application of the law cannot be and should not be, in our view, on behalf of Rail. So returning back to the attorney's fees question.
Before you get back to the attorney's fees, one of my concerns is, doesn't this open a floodgate for a kind of Monday morning quarterback? Boy, the insurance adjuster should have been, go to trial, and it's above my deductible. Boy, the adjuster should have been able to settle it for half of that and didn't. And if it opens it up for that kind of Monday morning quarterback sort of thing, that's, of course, bad public policy, it seems to me. Can you respond to that, please?
And with due respect, Justice Bradley, it would be bad public policy not to follow the existing law of covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Now addressing your question. In the Anderson case, which is a first-party case where the furnace is bad and it's a $4,000 claim, ultimately, could have been settled, paid, property damage to the homeowner, $4,000. One of the things that the insurer was arguing is similar to what you might be raising, the floodgates, or the opinion talks about the insurer arguing that there'll be extortion-type claims. Let's reflect on what Rail had to do to get to the point where it had an 8-day trial before a jury and think, well, people are just going to second-guess, and I appreciate that's a public policy concern. They're going to second-guess the adjuster. That is not going to happen. For Rail to take on Liberty Mutual, all of those discovery motions that are referenced, all the depositions that were taken, 8 days of trial. So I think if we follow what I think is existing law in the state and apply it to these facts, there will not be, Justice Bradley, a floodgate or opening or second guessing of a bunch of lawsuits. I do think oftentimes a party who's a defendant or respondent make such an argument, but the reality isn't that, because after Anderson, has this state been faced with a flood of what the opinion addresses of extortion-type lawsuits? It has not. And there are not going to be many cases where liberty engages in this type of conduct again if that part of the bad faith finding is affirmed. They're not going to do that again. They clearly will have learned that that's not appropriate.
Is there a particular provision of the insurance agreement that you folks rely on that sort of embodies the duty to investigate and defend and settle? Or is it all in law?
Well, the contract does provide a framework for what the responsibilities are of the insurer. And then we have, in this case, the conduct of Liberty as it was representing what they would do because of the unique circumstances of a $500,000 deductible in terms of the experienced people that they would put on this type of case. So it is both those representations, the policy, but also the application of Wisconsin law to the facts of this case that frame up the basis upon which we have a bad faith finding, which is simply a factual finding by a jury having listened to the testimony and weighed that testimony out.
Let me ask one other question. Are you familiar with the case of Trinity versus Tower Insurance?
I am not.
It's a case where the circuit court entered summary judgment, if memory serves me correctly, on a bad faith claim. And then this court sent it all back for a jury trial on attorney fees.
Justice Prosser, I can respond in this way. Our basic position is that the trial court, Judge Lindell, as a practical matter, and as a matter of public policy, also balancing the rights of liberty, is in the best position and should be the person that determines the award of attorney's fees. I can also indicate to the court that if somehow attorney's fees represents a jury question, which we believe strongly it does not, it simply cannot be tried simultaneously with the bad faith claim. That's a public policy where the lawyers are going to end up to be witnesses in the bad faith claim. That gives the insurer, in my view, more of a hammer than they could ever want or need, because we ought to determine whether there's been bad faith. And then if there's bad faith, the trial court ought to be able to determine attorney's fees having heard the case.
So in this particular case, I dissented because I was troubled that there would be a jury trial on the attorney fees when the court is going to tell them, we've already decided this company's in bad faith, so you just decide how much you're going to pay.
I think if we look at the cases, DeShant, Majorowicz, Danner, in each one of those cases, in some form or another, it was the trial judge who ultimately passed on the award of actual attorney's fees and judge the reasonableness of those fees. And that's all we're asking that we apply in this instance. My red light is on.
Yeah, I have one question.
Yes.
You all discussed with the judge attorney fees, either preceding or during the trial.
Correct.
And yet, when it came to instruct the jury, did anyone ask that the jury be asked about jury fees?
I can summarize it in this way. At the time of the pretrial before Judge Lindell, Mr. Biegert raised with the court, this would have been December of 07, Madam Chief Justice, because it was the pretrial to discuss verdict form instructions and so forth, that Rail was going to be taking the position that attorney's fees award was post-verdict. Liberty was taking the position at the pretrial, and I'm sure before, during, and after, that it was a jury question that need to be on the verdict form and submitted instructions or verdict form perhaps consistent with that. Now when the case is done and it's not to be submitted in terms of jury conference, again, we took the position that those fees, you needed to have the factual predicate of bad faith before you ever got to the fees. And to put it all in while the jury is determining and focusing on the bad faith conduct, and put their head over here on the reasonableness of fees, with the advocate being the witness, was not appropriate. Liberty's view consistently was that they had a right to a jury determination of the amount of fees, and our view is that that's not consistent with Wisconsin law. I hope I've responded.
You have. So was an objection made that it wasn't on the jury verdict? I want to be sure this has all been preserved.
I'm not understanding.
I will check with the
I don't believe that Judge Lindell ever committed himself one way or the other to that fact. Whether it needed to be on the verdict form, he would take it up post-trial. That's my recollection of the record. Thank you.
And that's not what I think you have in the brief. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
William J. Catt, representing Liberty Mutual Insurance Company.
Thank you, Your Honor. It's Cott, but you can call me whatever you want.
As long as it's pleasant.
May it please the court, my name is William J. Cott of Lead & Cott in Milwaukee, and I am privileged to represent Liberty Mutual Insurance Company in this case. We have two issues, two appeals to address, and I had intended to address initially our appeal, and I would like to spend quite a bit of time on that appeal with respect to a cause of action. But because of the question you just raised, Judge Abramson, I'd like to address that issue immediately.
Right.
Mr. King was not present at the trial. I was present at the trial. The fact of the matter is you asked, did we object, Liberty, to the statement that these attorney's fees should be determined as part of the jury proceeding. In fact, the request was never made one way or the other by the plaintiffs to say, we are going to have these handled afterwards. Those were conversations between counsel that was never put before the court. There was never requested a ruling from the court ahead of time. I noticed in Rail's briefs that they said we didn't get any guidance. They didn't ask for any guidance at either the pretrial or when we had our conferences at the jury verdict conference.
And did you ask that it be put on the jury?
No, there was no reason for me to be asking that it be put on the jury.
Damages be held against you. That's your point.
Right. They were the one to prove up the damages, and I'm not in the habit of saying please put it on if they're not going to prove them up. And so that with respect to that, that's what occurred there with respect to that particular issue. I would like to come back to that, but one of the things that I'd like to point out here that really the issue before this court, I think, with respect to the bad faith issue is, does Wisconsin recognize a claim for third-party bad faith when the only claim is for a deductible? And that is important. And one thing I could ask this court to come away with is this. A bad faith claim is for extra contractual damages. The damages that they are seeking in this case, and always were seeking, was a contractually bargained for risk, i.e. the $500,000 deductible. All of the other cases that they cite deal with extra contractual damages, and you just don't have that here.
Well, is extra contractual damages the same thing as I've been calling over and above the policy limits?
Yes, but in the first party context, it's something else. You know, it's also extra contractual damages, but it's not for not a deductible. It may be for other damages.
Like what?
In a first party case like Anderson, they indicate that they were damaged because they weren't paid. Okay, they weren't paid at all. The claim was not paid, and then there was a punitive component as well. But in the third-party context, when you're talking about it, I think the law is clear here, as pointed out by Justice Crooks from the time of Hilker, that it deals with excess limit cases. Hilker says clearly, so long as recovery does not exceed the limits, and it goes on then to say, the question of whether the claim be compromised or settled or the manner in which it shall be defended is a matter of no concern to the insured. However, where an injury occurs for which a recovery may be had on a sum exceeding the amount of the insurance, the interest of the insured becomes one of concern to him.
Counselor, how do you think that someone who purchases this kind of a policy with a high deductible should protect himself? How should Rail protect itself from what occurred here?
Well, keep in mind, Your Justice Rogan-Sack, we believe that the bad faith finding in this case was inaccurate because it was based on an inaccurate statement of the law. But addressing your question...
I understand that. I'm just concerned more on a policy basis.
If you look at this situation, what did Rail have in place here? They started insurance with Liberty in 1989. They continued insurance until 2004. They bargained for this deductible. Why? The same reason we all do to bargain for a deductible, to get a lower premium. They had the kind of bargaining power that they had a representative of Liberty come and meet with Everett Rail personally on claims. They had special handling instructions, which we have in the record in this case, that allowed them to approve reserve increases. In fact, even in this case, the reserve increase was approved by Rail on two occasions, once to $250,000, once to $450,000. They also had in their special handling instructions the ability to give input on counsel, and in fact, counsel was changed at this point. There's a number of other things because of the big bargaining power they had that they had ability to be thoroughly involved in these claims. Also, if you look at this case, at the very beginning when this rear end accident happened and Liberty Mutual wanted to contact the driver of the car that had been hit, the very first instruction they got from Rail was, let's make this a record-only claim. In other words, we don't want to make this a big claim at this point. Of course, their story has changed since then, but that's in the record. So they had a lot of ability to monitor what was going on in this case. But the bottom line is, they had a bargained-for risk, a $500,000 risk that was part of the contract.
See, I look at the risk a little differently. I look at the risk as a $1 million claim and they have to pay half of it. I don't look at the risk at all as because they have a high deductible, the folks that are supposed to defend them don't have to be energetic as they would if they had a $10 deductible.
With due respect, Justice, the idea that they don't have to be energetic, there was a dispute in this case about whether certain things should have been done and should not have been
right.
done.
Right. I understand all that, but I'm sure you know that we don't find facts. So the jury had this claim. The jury found the facts that go along with bad faith. And they may be totally incorrect, but I wasn't sitting there, and I'm not looking at facts, to be quite frank with you.
They made a bad faith finding based on an instruction that was given to them of a law that we say didn't exist at the time. That's
right,
the only
I understand
point
that, and that would knock the whole case out. But you were kind of arguing back to me when I said I didn't see the risk as being one where defense counsel shouldn't be energetic, that they were energetic. And they may have been, and that may have been the deal at trial, but I'm just looking at, from a legal standpoint, the risk. And what I was responding to was your statement, well, you know, they bargained for lower premiums, they got a $500 deductible, that's the risk that they took on. And I agree it's a risk if you compare it to $1 million of damages, they have to pay half. I don't see it as a risk they bargained for in regard to defense of the claim. And that's where I differ from what you're saying.
All right, let me just see if I can respond to that a little more directly.
Thank you.
First of all, when we're looking at the idea of a $500,000 deductible, let's keep in mind relatively who we're speaking about in terms of the type of premium that was charged and the policy in general. But the fact is they know when they're going in, when you have a trucking operation that has, some 1,500 trucks nationwide, you know what kind of risks you have in terms of bodily injury cases and so forth. So they know when they sign that contract, there is a possibility that they're going to end up having to pay on their $500,000 deductible.
Sure, I don't have a problem.
And so I guess I don't see how that then is a situation where they're going into it unawares. They're completely free to bargain.
We're talking past each other. When you have a third party coverage, in this policy, you got two things if you were the purchaser. You got indemnity, which started after you got to $501,000, and you got a duty to defend. That starts when either a claim is presented to the insurer or whatever the starting point is generally, okay? I'm concerned about your saying that they assume this risk when they got a big deductible, and I don't see how the big deductible bears on the duty to defend. We're not communicating.
Well, I think it goes back to Hilker And I think it goes to the explanation of Hilker in the Huss case, because they recognize in there, for example, in Hilker it says, where an injury occurs for which a recovery may be had in sum exceeding the amount of insurance, and now they're saying for deductible here, the interest of the insurer becomes one of concern to him. But they talk about the fact it arises because the insured has bartered to the insurance company all the rights possessed by him to enable him to discover the extent of the injury and to protect himself as best he can. That's the trade-off, I guess, is what I'm saying, Your Honor. That is the trade-off, that because they get this deductible, they are ceding that to Liberty as to how that particular part is handled. And Huss comments on what you're talking about. Huss says, we agree with the general notion mentioned in Anderson and other Wisconsin decisions that an insurance contract carries with it an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And the rail has continually stated there's a covenant of good faith and fair dealing. Judge Lundell said there's a covenant of good faith and fair dealing. But that's not the full analysis. The second part of that analysis is this. Courts in general, and I'm quoting from Huss, and Wisconsin courts in particular recognize only specific cognizable causes of action implicating this implied covenant. And we are not in a position to expand that list. The reason they say that is because their review of Wisconsin law is there's a bartering that goes on here. We agree to give you a lower premium. You get a deductible, and we have the right to control how that deductible is handled. It's a different analysis than when you're dealing with potential damages to them that are outside of what they contracted for, such as an excess verdict. It's just a different analysis.
I'm going to pick up on Justice Rogensack's question, because I think arguably what they contracted for is a risk of exposure, not a risk of actual liability. That is that, you know, they contracted for a high deductible. That means that they knew that they had a risk of exposure up to $500,000, beyond $2 million, up to $500,000. But in contracting for that risk of exposure up to $500,000, I don't think that they contracted that they would have to pay $500,000 if they weren't actually liable. They didn't contract that they would have to pay if, assuming bad faith here, I'm going to assume it, okay, just for my question. They didn't contract that they would have to pay $500,000, not because they weren't liable, but because there was bad faith in investigating and in defending. I don't think that was part of the contract. I mean, when you get a $500 deductible, $500,000 deductible, it's the risk of exposure. I don't intend, if I have a case that's only worth $150,000, that I would have to be paying $500,000, but for the bad faith in investigating and defending. So it seems to me there's a conflation between risk of exposure and risk of actual liability here. Can you help me with that?
Well, if you're the insurer dealing with the insurance company, mm-hmm. and it's time for your policy renewal to come up, you're dealing with potential exposure, okay? Now, risk. I guess I don't see a difference there, respectfully. I don't see a difference there. You're going, because we're looking at what are these parties doing when they're contracting together. Right?
Well, they're not contracting for the idea that I'm going to have to pay because of the bad faith of someone, because they, again, I know this is contested, but for purposes of this question, because they blew the investigation and because they blew the defense, why should I have to pay?
Well, actually, what the trial was about was what were they damaged as a result of this bad faith. Mm-hmm. And the contention of the plaintiffs was the case could have settled for $100,000 instead of the verdict, and it came back with a damage award of $127,000. Mm-hmm. So our point in going into this case, when we brought our motion, was the law in Wisconsin says you have to have an excess verdict, right? And the fact is these parties were able to contract ahead of time, and they knew there was a potential for $500,000 worth of damage in any case, whether you call that a exposure or an actual damage. They know that's there. And in terms of the law that we have here, how that $500,000 is handled is within the bailiwick of the insurer. That goes back to Hilker. That goes back to the very beginning.
I smile when I think of Hilker, because Hilker says, if it's not less than the policy limits, or stated another way, it should only be of concern to the insured if it's in excess of the policy limits. I say, yeah, tell that to the insured. You know, I mean, in this kind of a fact situation with high deductible. But my final question that I need help with in terms of a response is, it seems to me that your argument would say, as long as it's within the deductible, we can do anything we want. We can engage in bad faith. And this, of course, is something that your opposing counsel raises. We can engage in bad faith with impunity because there's no consequences. That's disturbing. So can you respond to that?
Let me get that question, so thank you.
Obviously.
The question is, again, with due respect, is not, that's a hypothetical that I believe is not consistent with the reality of the bargaining powers and the marketplace here. Because here's what you have. This is an annually renewable policy. As I said before, 1989, they started with this arrangement, and they have the right to say, we know what our experience is, we know what our potential exposure is in cases, and we know what we can get from you, Liberty, if we get this kind of policy. We know that if we get a $500,000 deductible, because of what the policy language says, that you have the right to control, that there is a chance that you could settle a case that we don't think is worth $500,000, but you do. We know that going in, but we're willing to take that risk there because we are saving, as the real people admitted, hundreds of thousands of dollars on premium. Now, if they find that Liberty, during a one-year course or any period of that course, is not doing what they expect of them, is not doing the investigation they want, is not doing the kind of defense they want, is settling claims that they don't want settled, they don't have to renew the next year. And that is why there is a distinction by the courts based on the different policy and the trade-off parties get when you pay a premium and you turn over a duty to defend, you turn over control. The insurer gets a big benefit of that. And that is why the courts have said we are not going to have a bad faith situation in third-party cases unless there's an excess verdict, because that is something that was not bargained for. That was not something that was a contractual damage. That was an extra contractual damage. We're really talking about, Justice Bradley, the policy behind what the case law has done all the way to now, which is have it be extra contractual damages, not something that was contracted for.
Your comments, though, and your response make it sound like, you know, you've got two strong bargaining folks here. But a lot of people, a lot of ordinary people, are buying high deductible policies, and they don't have that kind of input. That, oh, let me see how you handle all of our claims, and I'll see if I'm going to renew the next year. I mean, this is a one-shot thing in their lives with a high-deductible policy.
Well, I would say this. This is a deductible in a liability policy, which is very unusual to have a deductible in a liability policy where you have a duty to defend, all right? And, in fact, this insured certainly was a highly powerful insured. They had a lot of bargaining power. I think your point points to a bigger problem if you adopt the plaintiff's position, because what kind of policies are we getting where there's getting to be higher deductibles for individuals? Health policies. That's on the horizon. So you can see more of that. And so one of you asked a question earlier, aren't we opening a floodgate of litigation? If because there's no reason it should only apply to a high deductible, if they're right. Why not a $50 deductible? Why not a $100 deductible? Why not a $250 deductible? Can the court set a number at which it makes a difference? The fact of the matter is, if you open this up, anybody who has a deductible on their health insurance policy, if they don't like how their claim was processed and how a hospital was paid, would have a claim for bad faith. And the fact now is that is not the case, and I believe you'd be opening a floodgate of litigation in this situation. So that's where I see that impacting.
Whose party, third party, though, this affects?
Sure, but under this.
You withdraw that.
All right.
This is the same question in a different dressing. According to my notes, which may or may not be correct, but we can always listen to it on the tape, I guess it's disc now, Mr. King started his argument saying Liberty's position is that it has no duty until it reached the deductible. Is that your position?
No, I think that's actually a misstatement of our position and a misstatement of the law.
I would like you to state your position. And then, that's in part what I hear Justice Rogensack talking about. And then, state your position, whether this is the general rule, whether it's Mr. Smith taking out a deductible, or it's a special position because you have an entity that has strong bargaining power with the insurance company. So first, what is your position exactly on what your duty to defend is?
On what our duty to defend is, or?
Yeah.
Let me see if I understand your question,
okay.
I'll address this. It's exactly what I said that Huss says. They want to make the statement that we're saying there isn't a covenant of good faith and fair dealing in insurance practice. We're not saying that, okay? But what we are saying, we're relying on, is the same interpretation that Prosser and Wood and the other justice made in Huss, which they said, just because there's that covenant of good faith and fair dealing, it doesn't mean that it says courts in general and Wisconsin courts in particular recognize only specific cognizable causes of action, implicating this implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And our statement is that when you are dealing with a deductible, because it is not an extra contractual damage, because the parties in the contract are presumed to be able to bargain for this, that there is no cause of action for bad faith when all that is involved is that deductible. You said, does it make a difference on the size of the parties? And I think this ties in with Justice Bradley. It appears perhaps that there seems to be a concern that, well, these other parties aren't going to be in the same kind of bargaining power. My point on that issue is, if you look at the opposite side of the coin, which is what I just expressed to Judge Bradley, then you're going to have a floodgate of litigation. Mm-hmm. It goes back to a long-held policy in the insurance industry. You get a, don't forget, the insured gets a benefit for that deductible, lower premiums. And it's not a situation where the insurance company is getting all the benefit.
A traditional question I ask counsel is, if you had the opportunity, and I'll give you the same opportunity, Mr. King, if you had the opportunity to write this opinion, what would you write?
I had the opportunity to write this opinion?
You look very happy about the process of doing that, counsel.
Can I start now?
Right.
But if I had the opportunity to write this opinion, I would look at the Huss case and look at how they analyze what the different policy considerations. Think of the long precedent of Hilker and say exactly what I just got done talking to the court about, which is, yes, there is an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, but there is not a cognizable action if all we are dealing with is something that was contracted for. That seems to be a policy decision the courts have made in this case, and it seems to be a wise policy, in my opinion, because, in fact, you are going to, with increasing deductibles, you are going to increase the amount of lawsuits you're going to have. You're going to increase all of those things.
In other words, no bad faith claim unless the damages exceed the limits of liability.
Or some other extra contractual amount.
Yeah, I keep asking you that, but at least in this case,
right.
That's what your your rule of law is.
Yes, based on the existing law that we have.
Well, the existing law that we have does not deal with any case in which the damages were less than the policy limits, right?
Right, which is why I brought my motion to...
That's right. The question then is in each of these cases, starting what was Ilker, 1930-something or other, 20-something or other?
31.
31, thank you. Starting with that, you have every case that comes up excess of policy limits. Now, from that history, you want to draw the rule that that limits liability. But you could argue that judges deal with the facts they have, not with the facts they don't have, and that all of those are fact-specific cases. That doesn't have a negative pregnant that any other facts, therefore, will have no recovery. How do you respond to that?
Well, two ways. One, there's an old adage that bad facts make bad law. And in this particular case, what's interesting is we're concerned about, what could have occurred, but we never had, in this case, either the party who was controlling what was going to be offered, Mr. Rail, or the party in the underlying case who was going to accept an amount, Mr. Groth. Neither of them ever testified in this case about, I would have offered this amount, and I would have accepted this amount. That's another issue we've raised in our brief. So they brought in expert opinion to say, this is what would have occurred. So that's a really bad underlying thing to change the law, is what I would say. Secondly, I would just reiterate what I had said earlier. We have to keep in mind here, there's a policy idea going on here, which is, are we going to be able to rely on the contractual bargaining of these parties and the benefits they get in that contractual bargain, in other words, lower premiums, or is the court then going to step in and say, getting that lower premium isn't enough, you also are going to be able to bring a claim for a risk you specifically contracted for? And I would say that opens up a floodgate, as I talked about earlier.
Thank you. You will be...
I didn't talk about the attorney's fees, but we'll rest on our...
You got another 5 minutes.
I think I can only address the...
You're right. Legal issue and sufficiency fact. Mr. King.
Great to have the music behind me.
I know. The requirement of the court is that you speak in synchronization with the music.
I'm going to sit down.
Not required to dance, however.
Fortunately for you all. Picking up on counsel's last point, Rail Transport, a trucking company here in Wisconsin, did not bargain for bad faith. Never sat down and negotiated bad faith. Never negotiated that we would be treated as this jury found in St. Croix County. I want to begin on the attorney's fees, citing back to the record in page 27 of our brief, because we do mention on page 27 that at the pretrial conference, Rail, in the presence of, in the occurrence here of Mr. Biegert, informed the trial court that pursuant to Wisconsin law, it intended to seek fees through post-trial motion. And we cite as a reference for that the post-trial motion of Liberty, and we're pulling that quote directly from Liberty's post-trial motion, which said this was discussed before Judge Lindale as a part of the pretrial.
Your complaint had a recovery of fees.
It certainly did. And everyone understood that that was a part of the case, and I return back to my initial point. The only question is the mechanism by which that's determined, not a question whether we're entitled to it, because we are. once there's a finding under DeShant. I want to return as well to what's really being suggested to you by Liberty's argument. Liberty's argument is that they are acknowledging that there's this covenant of good faith and fair dealing, that they had an obligation to investigate, that they had an obligation to analyze the claim, that they had an obligation to defend. But all of those duties and all of those obligations, in their view of Wisconsin law, lie dormant. They sit. They have no consequence to Liberty whatsoever unless and until there's an excess verdict. Here, there's $500,000 of the policyholder's money wasted. That wasn't something that would have been contemplated in Hilker because Hilker didn't have those kinds of policies. So if we think of the public policy of the state, it certainly adjusts and moves in accordance with what's being placed out in the marketplace. And this was a risk that Rail could not have contracted for. Dear policyholder, I'm going to ignore your claim. I'm not going to assign it to anybody that's experienced. When I defend it, I'm not going to have an accident reconstruction. I'm going to do all of these things. But I owe you nothing unless and until it gets in excess of your $2 million. We didn't bargain for that. And there's nothing in this record that indicates that Rail Transport was in a strong bargaining position or had strong bargaining power. That's not an issue. That's a lawyer argument. But there's nothing factually determined that that's the case here. Nothing. The argument is, in essence, that there are market forces that create immunity for a national insurer in a bad faith claim, that they somehow bargained. That's not the law of Wisconsin. And picking up on your point, Madam Chief Justice, if I was assigned to write this opinion, first of all, in the language of my kids, it would be an awesome responsibility because I would be now looking at public policy in the state of Wisconsin. And the first thing that I would do would be to question whether I was qualified to do it, but since you've asked, I'm just as an advocate. I would certainly be looking at the facts of this case because that's what I'm deciding. But I'd be looking at the public policy of the case and of the state. And as a public policy matter, there isn't such an argument as there are different standards for de minimis cases in a personal injury case or a medical malpractice case or a breach of contract, that we have lesser standards or higher standards depending upon the amount. I'd look at the public policy. I would be concerned of first party and third party bad faith. And what will motivate an insurer to protect the rights of the policyholder? And to let Liberty walk under these circumstances can't be a good signal public policy-wise for policyholders in Wisconsin and the people that are injured in accidents like Mr. Groth was injured. So I would write the opinion on the basis that the public policy of this state does apply to these facts. We're simply applying the existing law in Wisconsin to a high deductible setting, and I would write it in such a way that the attorney's fees are recoverable as a matter of law and that the trial judge is in the position to make that award after the verdict because the trial judge heard the case and determined the case.
Well, in my interest of simple, plain writing that we understand, or I understand, then were you saying that there's a bad faith claim even if the damages are less than policy limits? Or do I have to add only if you have a high deductible?
No, you need not, in my view, if I'm writing that opinion. Yeah. I do not confine the public policy of this state to high deductibles because it's the same law, Madam Chief Justice, that applies to people that have high deductibles like Rail or low deductibles.
When you're talking about the public policy of the state, you're talking about tort law, common law, judge-made law. Bad faith is an example, right?
Okay. Judge-made law didn't exist at the time the Constitution of Wisconsin was written. It's bad faith law is created out of, Justice Crooks is correct, the Hilger case of 1931 in Wisconsin.
Right. So your position, I gather, is that the Hilger case was based on its facts.
Correct.
For bad faith. This is based on different facts.
It is based on different facts and the same rationale and the same basis for public policy protection that arose in Hilker arises in Rail. And I would write it in a way that it would be clear to circuit court judges.
Well, rail, I'm sorry, we look at counsel other states. We're not bound by other states, but we look at other states. Does state law in other states go along with you?
We have cited authority to that effect, yes, both on the how attorney's fees are handled and then you need not have an excess verdict to have bad faith. Because if we think about what their argument is, if the verdict came back in this case, it didn't, but if the verdict came back at $1.9 million, Liberty says they can't be held in bad faith. If it comes back at $2.1 million, they can be. That can't be the public policy of the state for a deductible. If there's evidence in the case that they acted in bad faith, that they wasted the deductible, then I think a policyholder is protected in Wisconsin under the public policy of this state to hold the insurer accountable for that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. King. Counsel?
Mr. King was allowed to address issues that were not really on his appeal. May
I? Right, counsel.
Okay.
You can keep going through this. Go ahead.
Okay. Just a couple of things on that issue. Well, first I'll actually address that. His statement, rail did not bargain for bad faith. Now, I know when I raised this earlier, the court said we don't get into kind of the facts, but I need to explain something about the instruction here because and how that was crafted and how that affected the case.
Well, your brief deals with the sufficiency of the facts.
Yeah, I'm not really talking about the sufficiency of the facts. I'm talking about how the instruction was crafted.
Right.
Because this type of bad faith claim was not recognized in Wisconsin law, basically what happened at the jury verdict conference was they took 2760 and 2762 and took parts out of each, which instructions are intended to be a summary of the law, not the basis on which something new is built. And what's really important about that is this court has said, all right, we have a different situation here, and I think even the plaintiffs would recognize that the different situation is there was a bargaining process that went on. So then how does that get incorporated? How should that have gotten incorporated in an instruction on this new area of bad faith if there was going to be one? And so that's an important factor for this court to consider.
I got the impression from your brief that you thought that the trial court had no authority whatsoever to instruct in this case as it did because there were no jury instructions and no prior case permitting it. Is that your position?
Absolutely. The court created law, and it's not a law-creating court. And that was our position. Of course, it denied our motions, but now you're into the instruction phase where they've already denied our motion that this cause of action doesn't exist. So now where do you come up with an instruction? And the court was using 2760 and 2762 and picking bits and pieces out of it.
Well, if a trial court doesn't have a precise case that authorizes it, you don't think the court can proceed.
That's an awful general statement, and what I'm saying in
that's
this...
the impression I really got from the brief.
What I'm saying in this case is because of our position that you can't have a bad faith claim when you're dealing with a deductible, the trial court didn't have.
Okay, that's a question of law.
With respect to the attorney's fees issue, I just want to point out the fact that, very clearly, Chance said these are damages, right? We had a jury demand to try damages. We made it very clear that, like, and just as they talk about in DeShant and they talk about in Gardner, the one where this court says we base on Gardner, it's like medical expenses. You put a medical expense question on the verdict. To address Justice Ziegler's issue where how do you try this? Well, the Supreme Court rules specifically find that you can put an attorney on the stand to talk about issues related to fees, but they wouldn't have had to do that. They could have put on their accounts person and say, this is what we billed this person. And does it make it uncomfortable for them? Sure. They made a strategic, intentional decision. They didn't want that on there because they didn't want the jury to see what the fees were in prosecuting this claim. But that was an intentional decision they made not to prove up certain damages. They keep talking about the fact that there needs to be a mechanism in place. There is a mechanism in place to prove damages. That's called a jury trial when there's been a jury demand. And if there's any problem with procedure, it easily could have been handled in a bifurcated manner. There was a judge in this town in federal court who loved bifurcated trials, and you had to be prepared and you had to do them quick. And he would impanel the jury immediately, the same jury, on a damage issue right after liability. And that easily could have been done here, but they made an intentional, conscious, and strategic decision not to prove them up as damages, even though DeShant said they are damages. That's all I have.
I have a question about DeShant. The court said, hey, this is not dealing with compensation of attorneys. We're dealing with damages wrongfully caused by the insurer's improper actions. And in concurrence, I said attorney fees incurred in proving a bad faith, this is how I interpreted the majority, are not awarded as attorney fees, but as items of damages, so that maybe the whole rule of law relating to attorney fees in other cases where we're giving attorney fees may or may not apply.
Well, I was just quoting actually from DeShant where it talks about they actually use that, and I think that's at page can't tell what page this is it from, but the actual quote is they refer
to
the
Lexis
analysis.
Or Westlaw?
Yeah, I'm on
Stars.
Actually, it's page 572 under the Northwest site, okay. I believe. And it says, the Brandt Court drew a distinction between the recovery of attorney's fees, qua attorney's fees, such as those attributable to bringing of the bad faith action itself, and attorney's fees that are recoverable as damages resulting from a tort, in the same way that medical fees would be part of the damages in a personal injury action.
Thank you.
That's what I was referring to.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I want to thank both counsel in this case for a very interesting and helpful argument on yet another insurance case. Court has a large docket interpreting insurance policies and implementation thereof, and has had a number of bad faith cases. So here's another one with a different twist. This concludes our hearing in 08 AP 1303, Rural Transport versus Liberty Mutual Insurance Company. The students may remain. They'll be joined by other students. Justice Gableman will be out to talk with them. Anyone who wishes to stay may do so. The court is in recess until 1:30, at which time it will hear its third case. We are in recess.